Lady Rider, real one. When were you born, Lady Rider?
Where or when? On the 3rd of July 1923 in Leeds, in Yorkshire.
And what did your father do for a living?
Well, he was a farmer. I mean, he had quite a lot of land, which at that time was in a very depressed state.
What was your education?
Well, I went to a prep school and then I went on to Dependon in Kent, which was struggling at that time. It's become famous since, but in our day, anyone who went there had to work extremely hard for a career, profession or a trade. It was a rather unique school, and its founders were still alive and very much with it, and I think it had a marvellous spirit about it.
How old were you when you left there?
Only about 16, because I went straight into the Fanny, the oldest women's corps in the country, which had served with the Belgian and French armies in the line. They weren't accepted by the British until nearly the end of the First World War. And the Fannies still exist today, and they were quite well, they were very keen on training, as they are now, and so between the two world wars they went to camp every year, and they had weekly or fortnightly training. There were about 100 of them, I think. So when I joined up, it was still a small corps, but we had a tremendous esprit de corps and a great feeling of identity, and it was totally unlike any of the services in that sense. People knew each other by their, because it was small, and we were in great awe of those who'd served in the First World War. We called them sort of battle axes, but they were really women who'd had a tremendous experience in the line with Belgian armies and the French. They'd won a lot of awards, and they were quite rightly very strict.
What made you decide to join the Fannies?
Well, I didn't want to be mobilised. I didn't want to be mobilised or called up.
Why not?
Well, if there was something voluntary to do, then better to go in for that. I think the idea of being mobilised horrified me, and so I went, I suppose, a year before I needed to.
What was your reaction when you heard Chamberlain make the announcement that we were at war with Germany?
I was sickened. I think any of us that lived through the 30s were just, you know, fed up to the back teeth, to put it crudely. I think we were just disgusted by the whole attitude of either government, whoever was in power, and the fact that they weren't exposing what the Nazis were doing, that they were on the march, that they'd already occupied the Rhineland, and they went on declaring that they were going to occupy the world and they were going to have a 1,000 years rule of the Reich, and that they'd started the pogroms against the Jews, followed by the roundups of anyone whom they disliked. They'd passed racial laws in 1935, and the whole thing to us was just totally revolting. And at school, as well as at home, we were made very aware of all that was going on. We were made to read up avidly and have discussions and write up a lot of notes about it. So that for us, we saw that the war was inevitable, but we said, well, look how we've looked let down those millions who lost their lives in the First World War. I mean, so young, such young people, and in such ghastly circumstances. I think we were thoroughly ashamed of it. And, of course, we deplored the fact that we were futile and disarmed and weren't ready, and then sold out Czechoslovakia and followed by Poland. So we were furious, really.
What was your attitude towards Neville Chamberlain himself?
Oh, I just couldn't stand even hearing his voice, let alone his name mentioned.
And Churchill?
Yes, he and Vansittart sort of tried to rally, and I think they were the voices in the wilderness. I mean, surely Churchill was a great rallying point for the nation in the hour of its need in 1940, but I mean, the way he kept on saying that we were alone, well, of course we weren't alone, because we had the other allies who'd been occupied and overrun with us. He never seemed to give credit to people like the Poles, who knew what the Soviets were up to and kept warning him all the time, long before they come into the war, that they were going to probably try and master the world. He had complete blind spots, as far as we were told in SOE, the people who attended the war cabinet meetings.
Coming back to the Fanes, can you tell me about how you fitted into the organisation when you first joined?
After I joined, then I was sent to a training course, Kettering, near Norwich. It was quite an historic house, because the First World War Fanny owned it, called Ethel Boiler, and she was a writer. She was quite ill herself. And I think the course lasted for about, I can't remember, 3 or 4 weeks. It was fairly stringent. I've written all this in my book, Child of My Love, in some detail. And we were expected, in fact, we had to pass both oral and written examinations. They were fairly tough. There was night driving and night vision and map reading and core history and mechanics and preparation for driving every type of vehicle up to 7 tons, and as well as route marches. I think that training gave one insight of what was to come. I was told that according to what went up on the board at the end of the course, and if one had passed the examinations, depended one's sort of future destiny, because there were several sections of the Fanny. One section served with the Polish army in Scotland. And to my surprise, my name appeared under Bingham's unit, which was attached to Baker Street. So I reported to Baker Street.
Is that the particular part of the Fanny that you wanted? Or hadn't you any idea?
Well, I knew from a friend secretly something about it. Anne Russell, whose father was Lord Russell of Liverpool, and you remember him, he was one of the judges at the Nuremberg. And Anne and I were friends, so she told me a little, tiny bit, because she was sworn to secrecy. So I went up in trepidation, wondering what I was going to be in for. And then I was grilled by security, quite rightly, for several hours in Baker Street.
What type of things did security want to know?
Everything. And they said that I would be watched from then on. And I agreed with everything they said. They'd obviously gone into the background in tremendous detail. And I had to sign the Official Secret Act. I was told that no one was allowed to write or talk about it from then on. And my book went through the censor. My two books went through the censor. And, I mean, I know it's digressing, but I just don't understand people who break that. Because if you are, in a sense, honoured to serve in an organisation which expects you to keep silence for the rest of your life, then surely you obey that rule.
You're thinking of the spycatcher
scandal. Well, I mean, several people who've tried to make money out of it. I think it's quite disgusting.
Can you remember who conducted the security investigation on you?
We never knew names there.
And so after you'd passed through the security processing, what happened to you?
I was taken in a vehicle. I went on a train to... There were two stations in Hartford, Hartford East and Hartford North. And I arrived at one of those stations, Hartford in Hertfordshire. And I was met, it's all in the book again, by a New Zealand fanny, and she said, well, this is one of the training stations for small arms and sabotage, and you will be expected to take the bods to the rail yards at Welin and Hitchin.
The bods were the agents,
yes,
were they?
You are never to mention anything to anybody here of what you see or hear. There are about four or five of us. And it was a place where the boys that murdered Heydrich also trained for a bit. And also where a few of the Norwegians, they were only there for a very short time, who carried out the heavy water attack. And we had a very, very strict colonel, Colonel George Ream. And we were all very frightened of him.
Why was he so frightening?
Well, he was extremely strict. We weren't allowed to leave Station 17. I think he was just rather overpoweringly sort of... I suppose he expected it, us to be more efficient because of it, because of his attitude. I'm not sure if he altogether approved of Fanny's, but anyway, he had to. It was laid down by General Sir Colin Gubbins that he thought women, particularly young ones, were better at doing this work than men, for reasons which, again, I've written about. So I wasn't there very long, but several months, and from there I went on to do it. A course in not as a radio operator, but I had decoding.
What precisely was the type of work you were doing at Station 17?
I was mainly driving. We had to do anything, I mean. And we learnt shooting there.
What impression did you get of the agents you came into contact with there? What kind of people were they?
They were from Norway and Denmark and Holland. A few of the poor devils had dropped into Holland and then were immediately arrested because the code had been broken. There were French Canadians preparing for the Dieppe raid. That was a disaster and not thought of at all well by SOE. Belgians, there were a few Belgians on that course. No, I don't think they were French, because we had nothing to do with the French section. They might have come there, but we certainly didn't have contact with them.
Were the agents of all types, or of a particular type?
No, they came from different backgrounds. They were mainly very young, either in their late teens or early 20s.
Did you feel sorry for them, or admire them,
no.
Or what?
Oh, no. I think one had a tremendous respect and admiration for them. We were never ever allowed to pass on or talk about, even with other fannies, and there were very few of us. Once we'd known somebody by his Christian name or her Christian name, because of security. And we had platonic friendships, which I always believe in life are possible. And that was the rule laid down, and that was the rule we followed. It wasn't broken.
How much of a strain was the work at this particular station? Were great demands made on you or not?
Yeah, well, not so much there as at the op stations, the holding stations, where we operated during the moon period. It was only during the moon period that the pods, the agents, were dropped. They did have one dropping in, not in the moon period, but that was very special, and it was never repeated. And there, we were often overcome by, I suppose, tiredness, really, just physical tiredness and mental tiredness. But we were never allowed to show it.
What would happen if you did?
I suppose we would sort of been banned, as the security people had told us, that we would have been sent off to some remote island or something. And we knew, of course, that both in Hartford and wherever the op stations were, both in Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire, that security was there, all right. So it really never occurred to us. I mean, we got up to various silly pranks, but we would never have dared to do something.
What did being on ops actually involve for you personally?
It meant that we... well, we were asked, which is a bit off the record, by the people who'd really gone through, followed and an agent's career, and that if we thought that he or she was under special strain and might conceivably after capture give way, that anything like that we had to watch out for. It was quite a lot to ask somebody of our age. But they were young too, and after all, everybody reacted differently. Some were extremely nervous, some were very frightened of what they were going back into, having seen it already, having perhaps once been arrested by the Gestapo or by the Soviets. And then later on, in 42, we had the first Pole coming out of Siberia, and we were completely horrified by what they told us.
What did they tell you?
That people had resorted to cannibalism, that the Soviet system was on a par with the Nazi system. They reminded us of that they'd fought against the Bolsheviks in after the revolution and driven them back out of Poland, and that there was a great danger that if the Soviets succeeded in overrunning Central Europe, then they would never regain freedom.
How had they managed to get out of the Soviet Union?
There was a pact between Sikorsky and Molotov in 1941 when the Poles were allowed to make contact with each other over this vast, huge country. And those who couldn't be assembled and had survived, but they were in a terrible state. They had typhus and many other diseases, and of course they were suffered from hunger and every possible imaginary horror in these remote gulags and prisons, and huge numbers of them had died. I mean, we reckoned that about 1.5 million to nearly 2 million Poles were deported, of whom we don't really know how many did actually get out through Anders. The rest couldn't be traced, so they were left to be rounded up by the Soviets, and they were obliged then to fight with the Soviet army later on under General Behrling.
Now, you were saying earlier about being warned to look out for signs of crack-up with agents. Did you actually have to report that in your own case?
I can't remember. I think there was one boy, he was only 18, called Robert, or that was his, the name known to us, and he was a courier. Couriers had a, I suppose, perhaps the radio operators had the worst time because they carried this wretched receiving set with them. One is now in the museum, but to us they seemed to have the worst time because, I mean, if they were caught with the case, then they'd had it all together. They had no way of disguising themselves. And they were on the move perpetually. Well, so were most of the agents. Quite a lot of the radio operators were girls. But the couriers, too, in a different way, had a frightful existence because they were sent to all parts of Europe, not just within... You know, Poland was divided by the Soviet army and the Germans, and a large part of it was incorporated in Soviet Russia and into the Reich, into the German part, and then there was a middle strip called the General Government, Gege, under this notorious Frank, the Governor-General who lived in the Royal Castle at Krakow. So the couriers had to break those when they were on their journeys, they had to break those frontiers and get over them. And they carried vital information in all sorts of ways, in a cigarette lighter or a tiny statue, religious statue, the microfilms. And we had to check before anybody left that they had absolutely nothing on them that could possibly give them away, that everything was made to look as though it had been made in Czechoslovakia or in Poland. So it was quite responsible work.
You were saying about this by Robert.
Yes, Robert used to pace up and down most of the night, and he had been captured, so he knew what was going to happen to him. And I think he just dreaded the thought of being tortured again. I don't really know what happened. I think he was killed.
Did you tip off your superiors that he was nervous?
No, I think because it was known already that he was, but he decided to go back, and I suppose Ed must have accepted him.
You talked about the danger of agents concealing material. Did you ever come across any foolish things which they had concealed which might have given them away?
No, nothing. No, we had to look out. They would never have willfully done it. We had to look out for any sort of marks that might have been on the clothing. We went through it time and again. And we used to go through, in fact, you'll see in the museum here, we used to go through the different streets in, for instance, Krakow or Warsaw or whatever the cities were. Not necessarily where they were going to operate, but just in case they had to get there. And it became very laborious to them, so they used to scribble on the back of playing cards during our inquiries as to whether they'd remember where they were. Because everything had to be remembered, never written down.
What was the aspect of the work that you liked most?
Well, I've never been asked that question. I don't know, really. I suppose you knew it was something which would never occur again in life. It was like living with people under a sentence of death, so that each group was different. Each group had about three or four people in it, and you're never allowed to say from one group to the other. Sometimes there were several groups together in the holding station, in the op station. But no group leader was supposed to know where the others were dropped. So, and they didn't talk amongst themselves. But we did get to know people very well. As I said, under sort of like a sentence of death. It's rather like living in nursing and working with people now who have a terminal illness. You know, they talk about things which otherwise they wouldn't talk about in life. So from that point of view, it was extremely memorable. And above all, we had enormous affection and admiration for them.
Was there any aspect of the work that you didn't like doing?
No, none at all. It consumed one. I mean, it became a way of life. And for me, in a way, it's continued, but in a different way, obviously, because, well, it's another story after the war and then ever since. I'm often reminded things happen today which remind me very much of those days. People say, well, how on earth can you remember things 40 years later? But I suppose impressions made such a tremendous impact on one that it was a part of one's life that you can't describe.
Which particular individuals in your particular section of SOE were the linchpins of the organisation upon whom it really depended?
The Poles had Bureau 6, as they called it. That was their section. And they didn't trust understandably the British, so all signals were done from Stanmore, and where I was posted for a short time. And there, all our forging was done at Brigands. That was station. Can you remember the station now? It was in Hertfordshire, Royden. It was an exception because the owners were allowed to live there. They've died since. They had four brilliant Poles there as forgers. I was asked at Stanmore never to say anything to anybody, and I can't answer your question to what we did there. But they didn't trust the British because they thought that anything that might have been coded or the reports coming in would be passed on to the British and used by them, manipulated by them against the Poles. And I think they had every right to have that suspicion. They knew they were going to be let down, that they wouldn't believe them, they wouldn't listen to them as to the Soviet domination and what the Soviet system meant. So one was privileged to be a part of that secrecy.
Did the Polish suspicion of the British affect you personally, as a British person?
Well, yes, I because I considered myself a Pole by then. I mean, I thought that they had every right to be suspicious. And I was really more Polish than British. I mean, they accepted us wholeheartedly, and one became really, as I said, Polish.
But did they withhold things from you simply because you were British?
No, never. They knew that where one's loyalty lay. I mean, quite, of course, a great deal we never knew about, but certain things we knew about, and we would never speak about them to this day.
You're still sworn to secrecy on certain things?
Yes.
Were you working with the Polish section the whole time you were in the SOE?
No, I was with the Czechs for a very brief, I can't remember if it was only a few weeks, I think, one of their holding stations. I knew slightly the boys, the bods who went out to murder Heydrich. The Czechs had a very small section, of course, compared. It was nothing approaching any of the other sections. But they did have very bad luck, a lot of bad luck.
How did you find the Czechs in comparison with the Poles?
Totally different.
In what way?
Well, very cautious in a sense. They had dreadful reprisals as a result of the their attack on Heydrich. The Poles were almost reckless in their courage. The Czechs and the Slovaks were inclined to be more cautious and see the consequences. Whereas the Poles said, well, it was right to do it. I mean, whether they were going to lose or not, it had to be done. And when talk was first